It goes without saying that for the perfection which we seek to be possible, there has to be a complete reversal of the relation which governs the movements of our life, the relation of our soul with mind, life and body. At present, as a rule, the king is subject to his ministers. The soul is involved and has to be subject to mind, life and body, which are supposed to be the soul's instruments. But the soul is far behind, and the little bit of soul that is active in our mind, life and body, it has to subscribe to the rules, to the laws of these principles of being. This has to be changed. The soul has to assert itself, and we must educate ourselves in such a way that the soul can exert its will, find its expression and act through the mind, through the life force and through the body. This is a complete change and a reversal of what is going on all along in the evolution of nature. The existing powers have to be dethroned, and the veiled monarch to be brought out and restored to the position which is his due. The first step towards this end is to find our true being. Normally, we mistake our ego self, to be our true being. But the true being is our higher Purusha, not the lower Purusha, who is identified with the ego, who is involved and lost in the rounds of nature. And the ego itself is not a Purusha, is not a being. Only yesterday, I believe, we were discussing in Life Divine that the ego is not a being. The death of ego does not mean the death of individuality. Ego is different, the being is different. Ego, as you all know, is a formation of nature in order to centralize the various contacts and impacts in the flux of nature to give a certain sense of stability, a point from where to act. This has been slowly evolved by nature. It is not the being. It is an instrument, an instrumental point of nature on which the soul may base itself and function in nature. But once this purpose of centralization of contacts, centralization of actions and reactions, this center has been strong, then it is time that the ego should fall off. The central point has to change its character. The outer crust of ego has to fall so that the real being within comes forward and occupies that seat. The ego is the pseudo-self, the false self, the lower self, what Sri Aurobindo would call the desire self. This desire self, the ego self, has to be substituted by the true being, the higher Purusha. And who is that higher Purusha of whom we can become conscious? The moment we, men, I mean human beings, want to know what is our true being, we become conscious of ourselves as mental beings. Mental because we think, we understand only through thought, we become aware only through our mind. Our contact with everything is through the mind. Nothing is true to us unless it is mentally rendered to our consciousness or our being. This makes man essentially a mental being. I say essentially because there are other poises of being to which we shall come later. Now, our higher Purusha, we say, is our being functioning in the mind. The being itself is not the mind. The mental being, what is called the Manomaya Purusha, is not the mind. Mind is an instrument. Just as this body is not myself, it is I who this to whom this body belongs. I am different, the body is different. Similarly, the mental being, the Manomaya Purusha, is different and the mind is different. The mind is a formation of nature. Nature as mental nature. It provides the basis, it provides the stuff, it provides the field for the true being, my Purusha, Manomaya Purusha, to function at that level. This becoming conscious of the mental being, the higher Purusha, is the first step towards the changing of one's relations with nature. And this mental being of which we become conscious, when he tries to see and survey the situation, what is the truth about himself? There are three intuitions, three intuitive perceptions that are possible, one after another. The moment we try to observe as mental beings from the level of the mind, what is going on, what is this nature, what is this life and all, we find a poise of detachment. Things go on moving, but the Manomaya Purusha, or the mental being observed, he takes the poise of the witness being. He is the Sakshi, one who observes, one who sees, one who watches. That is the first poise of which we become conscious. Second, as he goes on observing, the mental being becomes aware of the large area of action which is open to him, which is greater and vaster than the normal physical range to which one limits himself when one is not awakened. He sees that the range open to him for work, for movement, is larger than the normal physical range. This is the second perception. And third is, that he is not limited only to the body, to the life action, or even to the process of thinking. He becomes aware of a higher dimension or a depth which is spiritual, which adds a new element. And this becoming aware of the spiritual element, opening to it and putting on that spiritual character, absorbing the spiritual vibrations, is the third intuitive perception. These are successive steps which are normally experienced by one who tries to observe himself. No doubt, once you separate yourself from nature, there is always the possibility, and it does happen every time, that you come back, when you come to action, to the usual rhythm of nature. In the beginning, at any rate, it is only when you are not involved in action, when you keep yourself separate from nature, that all this knowledge, all this wisdom is there. But the moment you come back into action, into the field of action, you are once again involved in nature. You would ask, is there no difference? Sri Aurobindo says, certainly there is. Once a separation has been effected, that separation, experience makes a radical difference in the rest of the life. One always knows, even when fully involved, again thrust into it, that this is not my true position. One always remembers that freedom of separation, that transcendence over involvement, and there is always an attempt, conscious or half-conscious or subconscious, to swing back to that poise in which one is away from nature. And this experience, repeated again and again, consciously dug in, creates new grooves by which the mental being learns to hold itself separate from involvement in nature. We spoke of the experience of the being, the true Purusha in the mind. It is also possible to feel that being as poised, as organized in the life plane. As in the mental plane, as in the mind, so in the life. One feels that all the energies of life are flowing from one. One can direct them. One runs with them. One doesn't think so much. It is not thought that appears important, but it is the dynamic force of life with which one is completely identified and lost. Here also, it is possible for the Purusha, for the being, to withdraw, to separate himself from the current of life force and act as a witness, then assume control and then enlarge his sphere. Third, it is equally possible for the higher Purusha to feel his poise in the physical body. One feels that this body is myself. There is a great control over the body. Everything is involved in the body. And this is called the Annamaya Purusha. The being poised in mind is the Manomaya Purusha. Poised in the life force is the Pranamaya. And one poised in the body, the physical body, the material sheath, is the Annamaya Purusha. So whichever the Purusha, whichever the poise in which you awake to your true being, the necessity is to draw back, to create a separation initially between that nature and that being, corresponding being. Once the separation is achieved, confirmed, then one has to assume mastery. Once the mastery is established, thereafter a direction in a new swing of movement, training the nature to function differently, that is the next step. We spoke of the life being or the physical being, physical Purusha, life Purusha, in order to throw light on the other aspects of the situation. But man is essentially a mental being. To him, even his life, even his body is true, is vivid only through his mind. A sensation in the body is not true to me unless the mind renders that impulse in at my sensational level. If my mind is in trance, which is very rare, but if my mind is knocked out unconscious, which is more likely, then any stroke given to the body will have no effect on me. I do not feel it, because it is the mind that renders all experience true. So man is essentially a mental being, and any change that we want to effect in our life necessarily starts in the mind. We are all thinking beings poised in the mind, and it is but natural that our action for change should start in the mind. And there are two ways in which the mind sets about this work of self-perfection. First step, as I said, is to withdraw from nature, hold back. Now, as you withdraw, there are two possibilities. One is to completely disengage yourself from nature, refuse to give sanction to nature, and in this process bring about a stop to the whole business. This is the Sankhyan position, which we discussed last week, I believe, in our class on the essays in the Gita. That is one way. Second is, as one awakens to the inner realities, moving away as one does from external preoccupations and involvements, the vision widens. A larger consciousness, a wider being, sucks into it our in-looking mental being. The mental being loses interest without attempting to do so, and gets more and more absorbed in its own inner self. That way also there is a departure from nature. One is a complete cessation, not only from involvement in nature, but from its own existence as a conscious Purusha in the world. The second is a kind of immersion in a higher reality. But these don't solve the problem. The problem is one of perfection. Our goal is not to withdraw from nature, leave nature to itself, and either end our lives as self-wrapped souls or souls merged in the Leela of Brahman, but to communicate the knowledge, the consciousness gained to the outer being, to remold and reshape external nature in terms of the inner gains. And that takes us to the next step. Once the separation having been effected, thereafter, how to acquire mastery over nature in order to perfect it, that's a larger subject which we shall take up next time. Any questions? It is one of the alternatives open to the soul. Each soul is given freedom of choice by the Divine, whether it will continue in slavery to nature or it will withdraw from nature and end in a blankness or merge in the absolute, or whether it will work on nature and manifest the divine in it. This step of refusing the sanction, withdrawing the consent, is usually the first step. Whatever your goal, the first step has to be that. Because 90% of our movements of nature are of ignorance. 90%. So till this character is changed, the soul or the soul as poised in the mind has necessarily to discriminate and say, no, this is not going to be. I am not going to sanction this movement. By this persistent practice, nature loses its impulse to turn in those old grooves, and slowly you learn to function in such a way that part of nature goes in the right direction, part in the wrong. Thereafter, you allow the right movements but withhold the sanction for the wrong movements. So this is a constantly changing process. But the withholding of sanction is for movements of ignorance, for movements that tie you down. Philosophically, according to the Sankhyas, even if it is the right movement, you have to deny your sanction. Because the fact that the nature is a movement itself is wrong, they say, is antagonistic to the bliss of the soul. But that is a theoretical position which need not bother us.
You just said now that the soul has the choice, the alternative, between merging and between mastery.
Yes.
Which is exactly what I understood not only by this chapter but many other things in Sri Aurobindo. Then, in relation to that, the passage in Savitri, which we were reading a few days ago, where he's traveling on the seas.
Though, this is again a question of free will functioning is a part of determinism. There is a great divine will. The imperative, the order to all the souls that go originally is to manifest the divine. But each soul is given freedom. How it will manifest, to what extent it will manifest, or at some time it will say, I'm tired of it and I don't want to do it. So the divine will allows that scope. So even though the orders of the mother are sealed in the breast, when the orders are opened, he has the choice to do or not to do. That is the essence of freedom. This, we may say again, that even what he is going to decide is determined, isn't it? So, the fact is, even the sense of freedom is a machinery for working out the divine will. To put it in common sense, provision is made in the divine scheme for tired souls to drop off. God is also human, isn't it? Yeah.
What is this, what they call in India, the left-hand path, where you keep the old rules to work them out? What is the truth behind it? Do they stand back as they do, let me later?
No. The term left-hand path and the right-hand path, it has many connotations. The right-hand path, you may say, is the path of the Purusha, the soul, the path of knowledge, the path of concentrating on the development of consciousness alone, leaving everything else. The left-hand path is to accept nature, to progress through nature, not away from nature. Whatever is supposed to obstruct your progress, you take hold of it, subject it to the process of purification, orientation, and force it to yield to your will. That is the original idea. So, for instance, things of the world is supposed to be a snare. Life in the world, woman, sex is supposed to be a snare. Now all these things, they don't run away from these things. They take the problems as they come and they try their best sincerely to utilize them for further progress. It has its advantages, it has its dangers, it has its self-deceptive scope. But by and large, the original idea behind the left-hand path is greater, vaster in scope than the narrow right-hand idea. Today the left-hand path has fallen into disrepute because it is nature which has pulled down man, and it serves nature. So instead of man riding over nature, it is nature that rides over man. That is why it is discouraged. Otherwise, where the left-hand path is practiced in its purity, the emphasis is on the integral character of experience. You reject nothing that God has created. You give its full value to everything that is a part of creation. It may take long, but it is not a narrow path, but it is a large, wide and comprehensive path. One must have the patience, and more than patience, one must have the sincerity not to deceive oneself, to see truth as it is. So much so that for those who are sincere, even in sex experience, they have said that the quality of delight shows whether one is sincere or insincere to the past. If it is gross, if it brings down your consciousness, if it clouds your being, if it brings you an inch nearer the animal, it has failed.